as well to pick through as just an added thank you for people.
Did Elon Musk
see you there.
Get
thank
privileged
you.
Access to government citizen data, making him the most powerful man on Earth? What would this data combined with AI mean in practical terms for the vulnerability of the common man and woman? Are Elon Musk and Peter Thiel working with Donald Trump to slay the deep state and save taxpayer money? Or are they in it to build a new technocracy? How could digital currency be used to convince regular working-class citizens to go along with the elite orchestrated technocratic coup? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we examine the agendas of the billionaire tech pros behind the Trump administration and see that there is a heck of a lot more to be worried about than what has been recently appearing in the legacy media. In our first half hour, we will have a conversation with the author, journalist, and the co-founder of the Daily Clout, Naomi Wolf, about the digital theft Elon Musk perpetrated at the end of January and the repercussions for the public in America and beyond. Then in our second half hour, UK author and journalist Ian Davis joins us to talk about his latest series of articles entitled The Dark MAGA GovCorp Technate, which alleges that the wealthy tech lords standing in the shadows behind him are using their positions to further goals toward a technocratic future, whether Trump is aware of it or not. On this week's program, Elon Musk and Donald Trump, who serves whom? A technocratic future. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 21st, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. We believe that the assets of the land should be shared equitably between the indigenous population and the settlers who arrived later. Let us make up for the injustices which resulted from broken treaties and false promises made in the past, pay reparations, and work toward a future with mutual respect and partnership. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Ever since the destruction of sovereign Syria, the situation on the ground keeps deteriorating. The EU-NATO-backed terrorist quote-unquote government is resorting to extreme violence in an attempt to establish control over areas primarily populated by minorities, particularly Alawites and Christians. Thousands have been brutally murdered as a result of this terrorist takeover, with the new quote-unquote government sending its forces, composed of Al-Qaeda-affiliated armed personnel, to crush any opposition. This issue is now slowly becoming transnational as armed clashes are reported on the Syria-Lebanon border, namely the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, terrorists, now posing as the, quote, new Syrian military, unquote, are shelling and launching rockets at Lebanese border towns. That comes from the article, Tensions Escalate on Syria-Lebanon Border as EU-NATO-backed Massacres of Minorities Continue, by Drago Bosnick, posted March 19th, originally published on InfoBricks. The effort to stockpile arms, modernize forces, and ramp up defense spending serves as both a political maneuver and a demonstration of militaristic ambition, yet the underlying premise of their preparation remains questionable at best. For years, European policymakers and defense analysts have perpetuated the narrative of an imminent Russian invasion, painting Moscow as an ever-present threat to continental stability. This rhetoric, often based on worst-case scenarios rather than verifiable intelligence, has shaped military doctrines, strategic priorities, and public perception across the West, despite the absence of concrete evidence suggesting that Russia harbors genuine ambitions to launch a full-scale war against Europe. Western leaders continue to sound the alarm. This cycle of speculative paranoia has led to significant shifts in military postures as nations brace for a conflict that may never materialize. That comes from the article, The European Union and the United Kingdom, Preparing for an Imaginary War, by Professor Ruel F. Pepa, posted March 19th. The number of prisoners indicted for nonviolent drug offenses increased rapidly from 50,000 in 1980 to 400,000 in 1997. The presence of blacks and Latinos among these prisoners has been very high. In other countries related to the U.S.-led war on drugs, the situation could be even worse. In the case of the war on drugs carried out during the tenure of President Duterte in the Philippines, for instance, it has been estimated that as many as about 12,000 Filipinos died in the war on drugs, most of them from urban poor communities. Perhaps the most disturbing question relates to whether, at the same time as the war on drugs was continuing and sometimes related to this, did several actions of the USA government and its agencies actually contribute to a big increase in the illegal production and trafficking of drugs, including opium and heroin, among others? That comes from the article, Arrest of Ex-Philippine President Duterte Raises Wider Questions About the War on Drugs, by Bharat Dogra, posted March 19th. Smart cities are being promoted as the solution to environmental concerns and urban efficiency, but a deeper look reveals a sinister agenda. Governments and global organizations tout reduced carbon emissions, streamlined transportation, and enhanced sustainability as the driving forces behind these initiatives. However, beneath the surface, smart city infrastructures inevitably lead to extensive surveillance, restricted mobility, and digital authoritarianism. One of the critical components of the smart city agenda is the rapid expansion of 5G networks. Fiber optics are being embedded into roads under the pretense of infrastructure improvement, but the reality is that these systems facilitate high-powered surveillance technology. That comes from the article, The Smart City Infrastructure, A Digital Prison in the Making, by Lisa Miron and Dr. Mark Trozzi, posted March 19th, originally published on Dr. Trozzi's website. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. On the 12th of February, Naomi Wolf wrote an essay for her Substack, The Sack of Rome, Elon Musk's Digital Coup, which argues that the way Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency accessed on January 31st the U.S. Treasury's sensitive payment system responsible for disbursing funds to Americans, including sensitive personal information like Social Security checks, tax refunds, and other payments from the government may have jeopardized the public in serious ways and might actually have made the world's richest man also the world's most powerful man. We had a chance to interview her this week. Naomi Wolf is a former political consultant and co-founder of the Daily Clout, a platform that empowers democracy building. She's also an author and journalist and writes on the Naomi Wolf Substack. It is a pleasure having you back on the Global Research News Hour. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Welch. It's so nice to be speaking with you again. Thanks for having me.
People who got access, they had authorization to go into the financial records and to try to find ways of saving money, but it says that it was read only. Okay, so why do you have issues with that?
That's not the only thing I have issues with, but the early reports about that weekend, which I believe March 4th, was raised a number of alarm bells for people who deal with cybersecurity issues. And I run a tech company called Daily Clout, which does something very much like what Doge is focused on, in the sense that our mission also is to produce government data sets and make them available and understandable to users. So there were just a number of things that were completely anomalous in the world of cybersecurity, normal cybersecurity. One is that the people who were tasked with protecting the data were told to stand down and put on administrative leave. Another is that some of the people who were with Elon Musk that weekend were not identified, which is a total red flag for cybersecurity. A third, and this is not my opinion, I ran these questions by our cybersecurity consultant who, you know, does this for companies of all kinds. And other cybersecurity experts around the world have also been very upset, you know, since March 4th. And they're not partisan. They're just upset about cybersecurity. A third red flag was that Musk had with him someone whose company does cloud computing. And the only reason that you would need a cloud is to store data, right? If you're going to keep all the data within closed government systems, you don't need a cloud computing guy.
That's Tom Cruise, right? Tom Krause?
Yes, that's correct. Another red flag is that one of the young engineers was a 19-year-old whose earlier job was as an intern at a company from which he was let go, or when he left, the company said that he had leaked proprietary information to a competitor. That in the world of cybersecurity, a normal cybersecurity would be the end of someone's career, not a signal for a giant promotion, you know, to be Elon Musk's right-hand man. All of these are red flags. When other people were reassured because Scott Bessent said, it's okay, it's read only, I checked, and read only can also mean, in this context, copying and machine reading. And so then the question is, if you're doing machine reading, where's the data? A final red flag there, and then I won't even get to the more recent red flags, or I will if you like, is that the young engineers reportedly plugged their own devices into the government system. So all of these are breaches, right, of normal security. There were additional red flags. The person who is overseeing this whole effort now, the digital side of Doge, has said that he wants to centralize all the data in one repository. So right now, and I've been a White House spouse, and I've been a political consultant for the Clinton reelection campaign and Vice President Al Gore's campaign in 2000. So I know how the federal government works in terms of security, and it's siloed, right? The Census Department doesn't know what the IRS is doing. The IRS can't get access to your medical records if you're a veteran, and so on. It's very carefully siloed. But Doge wants to put all the, break down all the walls between the agencies. And really the only reason, speaking as a tech CEO, that you'd want to do that is to create a large language model, to create a giant vat of data that AI can learn from, right? And the other danger there, I mean, there are many dangers, but the other danger there is right now, before Doge mushed all our data together, it was difficult to create an everything app to switch people off, right? A social credit system. Like the, now I understand what you were referring to before we started talking on video. The way that Canadian truckers were switched off economically, you know, that's bad enough, right? But the U.S. government used to maintain its data in such a way that you couldn't combine people's medical records and people's address through the Census Bureau and people's, if they've been treated for substance abuse and if they've got student loans and what their contracts are for their companies, right? And all the data that the federal government holds in a confidential way.
But what you're saying is that if it's not like the government making the decision to cut down the truckers, it's this artificial intelligence will just decide based on certain things like, I don't know, all of these different, you know, drug use or what have you.
I haven't even gotten to the AI threat yet. I'll get to that in just a minute. What I'm saying is something a little bit simpler, which is because of confidentiality rules, which are serious. You know, federal workers can go to jail if they leak or exploit people's proprietary government information, right? Because Doge gets rid of all of that internally, right, and smushes it all together, it means that depending on where the data are stored, right, a social credit system can be easily created by Elon Musk that could switch anyone off, right? And it wouldn't even have to, it wouldn't be the government. It would be a private sector app. And he says he wants to create an everything app. But, you know, the filters of your finances could go on top of the filters for your address, on top of the filters for your credit score, on top of the filters for your social media, on top of the filters for, you know, your medical records. And that could switch people on and off, you know, and you wouldn't even know what's going on, right? If you say something critical of an administration, you know, now or in the future on your social media, this app could switch, you know, boost the cost of your mortgage for your home, right? Without you even knowing why, or put a D for dissident or a, you know, symbol for dissident when you check into a hospital and then you're on a ventilator and you don't even know why, right? So the app could just do that. And that's now possible, you know, given the way Doge has smushed all these data sets together, whereas it was not possible before. The other thing I want to stress before I even get to the AI issue is that the government, the U.S. government's data sets are like the most valuable in the world and the most pristine in the world. I mean, it's very easy and tempting to hate the government, but, you know, compared to governments around the world that are really corrupt, where you can just, you know, pay, bribe a government official to get the addresses of you know, your political opponents and go harass them, right, or hurt them, our data sets are very pristine, very carefully, you know, very fact-based, and very carefully protected. So now this brings us to AI. There's an arms race for AI. AI is only as good as the data that it eats, right? That's how it learns. And so, you know, right now what's out in public is like blogs and gossip and kind of not very high quality data. That's what AI can eat. That's what Elon Musk's AI, you know, can eat. There's this incredible hunger for good data sets so that AI can get better and better, right? And Elon Musk has his own AI. It's called AIX. Well, we don't know, right? But if Elon Musk is, well, we do know now, Elon Musk is using, as I predicted, because it was so clear that this was the value proposition here. It's clear to me as a tech CEO, you know, given that Elon Musk has set his own AI onto US government data sets, that AI, depending on how it's filtered, can now answer the question, where does Naomi Wolf live? Where does Michael Welch live? You know, how much does Michael Welch make? Has Michael Welch ever been treated for drug or alcohol addiction? Has Naomi Wolf ever been treated for drug or alcohol addiction? You know, where do Michael Welch's kids live? Where do Naomi Wolf's kids live? You know, and so on and so on. And we don't know the answer, right? We don't know if Elon Musk's AI is filtered externally, meaning it is secure within the U.S. system, or if it isn't. Anyone who has access to Elon Musk's AI, like China or the dark web, mm-hmm. right, could have access to what it's eaten, you know, in the government data sets. So it's very dangerous. And I don't think it's, I think it's worth noting. I'm not drawing any definitive conclusions at all, but exactly what I was warning people about, the kind of thing I was warning people about, which is an enemies list, emerged right after this all happened. Meaning right now, I'm sure you know, in the United States, critics of the war in Ukraine, you know, conservative commentators are being swatted in a very dangerous way. Well, someone got everyone's address, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not that easy to do. It's not impossible, but it's not as easy to do as it would be if, you know, there's an AI platform that has eaten all of their addresses through the IRS or through the Census Bureau. I mean, it was so clear to me that it was going to be Musk's AI, you know, based on everything I saw, that I wasn't surprised when, you know, a couple of days ago it was confirmed that it was Musk's AI. But if Musk hasn't donated or sold that software, that program to the United States, then everything it's ingesting can be accessed by anyone that can access Musk's AI. And it would definitely make Musk's AI, you know, more powerful than, as I said in my essay, any president, right? Yeah. Because, well, that's a very easy task, you know, find, but it could do very dangerous things in terms of national security. Like Musk was asking the FBI and other agencies, tell me five things you did in the last week. That seems like a very kind of benign question. It's not benign if you understand large language models, because what he's creating is a giant database of information. Now he puts his own AI on that giant database of answers. And then you can ask that AI, if you get answers from the FBI, which thankfully Kash Patel and Tulsi Gabbard and Pete Hegseth did not allow their people to answer, right? But it's scary enough that, that Musk asked. If they were to answer, then you could ask Musk's AI, give me a list of the undercover FBI operatives in the United States who are embedded to take out the cartels distributing fentanyl. And, you know, the cartels could get that list. Mm. Or, you know, where are all the Chinese sleeper cells in America and who are the FBI agents who are, you know, embedded with them or surveilling them? And you would get that list, right? Mm. So it's an incredibly dangerous hack, again, depending on how Musk's AI is structured. Yeah. But for his own business purposes, which is why the non-compete and non-disclosure issue is important to me, like right now, he's still running his AI business and his other businesses. So he has a legal obligation to his shareholders in those businesses. So he's got a legal obligation to make his AI as good as possible, right? And I don't see how that doesn't conflict with his obligation to us as someone, you know, working for the United States federal government. They're directly competing legal requirements to, you know, keep our data secure on the one hand or make it available to his AI on the other. So it's very concerning to me that we don't know the answers. They're huge questions. And also, as I keep saying, and people are really mad at me for raising these questions because they think I'm being mean to President Trump or whatever. But, you know, once this information is out the door, it's unrecoverable. It's over. It's gone. Right.
Could you talk about your own experience as the CEO of Daily Cloud? Because your company, it was hurt hard about, I guess, 4 years ago when you spoke about the mRNA vaccines and then you suffered censorship. And I mean, describe again what you went through then and then how that may have given you certain insights that are, you know, dismissed as, you know, your libtard or whatever that, you know.
God, it just doesn't end. Sure. So in 2021, I accurately reported that women were experiencing menstrual symptoms upon receiving the mRNA injection. This is, the, you know, the kind of thing I've been reporting on for 40 years as a feminist icon, which I used to be before I was canceled in 2021. And because the Biden administration put pressure on what was then called Twitter and Facebook and other social media platforms to censor me, there was a worldwide censoring of me and also a worldwide smearing of my reputation that all happened at the same time. AI was clearly in use then, even before it was announced that it was in use, because this all happened simultaneously. And we lost a six-figure investment in my company, and I lost my whole career, you know, that my whole life as a writer, liberal commentator, you know, talking to news outlets around the world was over, right? No one would talk to me from that world. I mean, it was kind of a blessing in disguise that conservatives and libertarians wanted to talk to me for the next 3 years. But that, you know, my career was over, essentially. And I don't know if in my lifetime I'll ever recover the damage to my reputation that is still there. You know, everywhere you see my bio, it starts with conspiracy theorist now, when it used to start with Rhodes Scholar, you know, advisor to a president and vice president, you know, 8 best-selling books, etc. That's not what's most important. What's most important is that I have experienced firsthand how completely a company like Twitter, you know, working with the federal government, can crush someone, right? And I also was in litigation, active litigation against Elon Musk, up to, like, I think about 3 weeks ago. I was in a class action lawsuit for against X for having censored me. My co-plaintiffs were Donald Trump and a number of other people who are censored by X. But I guess what I want to communicate is, in the middle of settlement talks, I read that Elon Musk had access, in theory, to Treasury records, which includes IRS records, or could include IRS records, which includes, you know, my tax return. So my posture at that time was, I don't need your money, right? You know, the principle of the thing is more important. You know, the Constitution is more important. I was negotiating. But if Elon Musk's lawyers or engineers had looked at my tax return, which otherwise is completely protected by law, right? Yeah. They would have seen that I, you know, there would be no more point to negotiating, because they would have seen that I needed the money, right? And so that's just a little example, but it was also quite terrifying, because if Elon Musk can see all the contracts with the federal government, he can see his competitors' business plans and business models. You know, if he can crush, if he can see anyone's tax returns, then anyone in America can be in the same position I'm in. Good luck suing Elon Musk. You know, what if your Tesla blows up? He can see your tax returns. He knows exactly how much you're making. You know, he can hold out until you're crushed economically. I mean, there are so many things wrong with that breach of confidentiality. And they disadvantage citizens so badly. So I guess I just happen to, twice in my life, have been on the receiving end of that. But it's very dramatic. You know, we're very lucky in America, even with the horrible times we've been through recently, that we still have, you know, a government that keeps our data confidential, or is supposed to. And we are horribly, horribly at risk, all of us. I mean, again, just look at the people being swatted. You know, like, anyone who's got access to Musk's AI, if it reads the data in the Census Bureau, will know where everyone lives. Like, just imagine how unsafe that is, how dangerous that is. If you're a dissident or a critic or an opposition leader, I mean, a part of why I'm so panicked about this is my grandmother lost 8 siblings to the Holocaust. And the only way the National Socialists were able to round up a bunch of Jews all at once was IBM helped them make the lists. They mechanized the lists, right? And so it was very quick. You know, they could round up the Jews before anyone could resist or organize resistance, or, you know, go off into the woods and try to form a militia. With our data, our personal data, where we live, who our kids are, you know, what our loans are, what our income is, what our medical records are, you know, we are all so vulnerable to any tyrant or any enemy, right? If it's China or Russia or, you know, Davos, you know, we're all existentially vulnerable.
The article in question is The Sack of Rome, Elon Musk's Digital Coup. My guest, the author and my guest, is Naomi Wolf. Thank you, Naomi, for agreeing to be on the program. It was a really treat having you on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Mr. Welch. Take care.
Naomi Wolf is a former political consultant, the co-founder of Daily Clout, author and journalist.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Elon Musk may have even higher ambitions than discussed earlier. He, along with Peter Thiel and a handful of other billionaire tech pros, are actually hoping to bring about a profound change in the way politics is done and on a global scale. Elon Musk is a major proponent of technocracy, which essentially sees problems and allows tech experts, as opposed to elected people, to make decisions for the public. The ultimate consequence of this kind of dynamic is the bulk of humanity being controlled like farm animals, while a select few, such as Musk, have peck rights and can do pretty much as they see fit. A new form of totalitarianism is in the process of being forged. Ian Davis has written about Musk and the technocrats and has come out with a two-part series of articles entitled The Dark MAGA GovCorp Template, focusing on this broader picture. Ian Davis is making his debut on the Global Research News Hour. He's an independent investigative journalist and author from the UK. His most recent book, The Manchester Attack, is free to subscriber to his blog, iandavis.com. Ian's work has been featured by The Corbett Report and published by The Off Guardian, Geopolitics and Empire, Technocracy News and Trends, Bitcoin Magazine, and other independent news outlets. Ian's more irreverent articles are posted on his Substack at iandavis.substack.com. Ian Davis, thanks so much for the generosity of your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Michael. Thank you very much for inviting me.
All of these tech billionaire giants are backing the Trump administration. Elon Musk, for one, is using technology to make government spending more efficient. They're collaborating to make America great again, behead this deep state and so on. But it seems as if their message is a kind of a Trojan horse. They're working this to their own advantage. And their ultimate plans, it seems, are technocracy and a dark enlightenment. So, I mean, we've already defined technocracy. Maybe you could add more if you like. But what do you mean by dark enlightenment? And how is that distinct from technocracy?
Yeah, so the Dark Enlightenment came out of Warwick University in the UK, or it's the ideas that underpin it started in Warwick University in the UK in the mid-1990s in a research unit called the Cybernetics Culture Research Unit that was headed by a guy called Nick Land, who's a political philosopher, a socio-political philosopher. And what they were doing was they were looking at the idea of Joseph Schumpeter's creative destruction. So Schumpeter argued that capitalism works by constantly reinventing markets. So, for example, and technology has a major impact on that. So, the example we might use is the destruction of the horse-drawn carriage market to be replaced by the internal combustion engine market. So, this technology moves forward, it constantly, there's this cyclical effect that Schumpeter called creative destruction. What Land and other people, like a guy called Mark Fisher, were looking at the CCRU was what those ideas of what Schumpeterian kind of creative destruction meant for technological advances. And they could see that with the advances in computing technology that we were approaching what they called the singularity, which was the point at which technology would become self-perpetuating. So we might consider, AI programs writing better programs and moving technology forward, at which point, they argued that humanity would lose control of technological advancement and technological development. And we would become secondary citizens subject to technological control, basically computer-generated and AI control. So they, you know, proposed a system by which human beings could keep up with the pace of this progress, which they termed accelerationism. So accelerationism is applying the concepts of Shumpterian creative destruction as a methodology for advancing not just capitalism, but also through the mechanisms of capitalism, society as well. And that then was picked up, that work was then picked up in the US by a guy called Curtis Yarvin, who wrote as Mencius Moldbug. And he kind of developed these ideas in the written form and explored them. And a lot of his stuff was pretty off the wall, kind of irreverent kind of analysis, but also deliberately provocative as well. And then that was picked up by Land. Land then, obviously, I don't know, you know, it's difficult to know what degree that Land was working with Yarvin, but certainly he picked up on Yarvin's ideas and developed this into a treatise that he published in 2012 called The Dark Enlightenment. And in that, he laid out, you know, he brought all these ideas together, and he proposed basically a privatized form of government. So this privatized form of government would be called GovCorp. And this was building on something that Yarvin explained, which was sovereign realms, which would be operated by what he called sovereign corporations or sovcors. So this would be a patchwork of realms in Yarvin's terminology. But Bland took this under the umbrella, applied this to the entire nation state and beyond, and said that the overarching corporate body that would control the state, and I mean, and we have to rethink the terms of the state here, because they're thinking about things in a very different way. It would be, you know, entirely in the hands of private capital. So they were literally talking about privatized government. And Peter Thiel is very closely associated with Curtis Yarvin. He backed Curtis Yarvin's own ventures. He's an investor in Yarvin's own business. And, you know, Yarvin has spoken about how he watched the 2016 election results with Thiel. He calls Thiel fully enlightened. If you look at Yarvin will, you know, there are numerous examples of Yarvin giving speeches at conferences, and then Thiel very closely echoing what Yarvin said at another conference. You know, they're obviously in line with each other's thinking. They obviously share the same kind of outlook. And obviously now Peter Thiel and Elon Musk. Musk is very much, you know, he's got a family history. He's steeped in technocracy. And both technocracy and what we might call the Dark Enlightenment, which we can call GovCorp, are closely aligned in many senses. And I think probably the best way to look at it is that technocracy is like the operating system for a privatized state. It's apolitical. There is no politics in either technocracy or GovCorp, the Dark Enlightenment. All political parties are done away with. Society itself is done away with. Nation states are done away with. They don't exist anymore. You have a network of realms operated by corporations, and we are considered to be what they call technoplastic beings, cyborgs. So we're like programmable subroutines within a society, which the technocrats called a social mechanism rather than a society, which is programmed, you know, to run in a very mechanistic, soulless way.
You mentioned Peter Thiel. He is a major figure in this administration, along with Elon Musk. But it should be pointed out that several of the figures in this administration, for example, J.D. Vance himself, he was considered a protege of Thiel. And, you know, he heavily supported financially. The U.S. ambassador to the Kingdom of Denmark was also Ken Howard. He was a PayPal co-founder with Thiel. Jacob Holberg, the Undersecretary of State of Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment. He was a pro-Israel and a senior advisor to another private surveillance firm co-founded by Peter Thiel, Michael Kratsios, science advisor and director of the White House's Office of Science and Technology Policy. He was a first-term policy specialist on artificial intelligence, drones, quantum computing, and cybersecurity. He worked for two of Peter Thiel's funds. Could you tell us a little bit more about Peter Thiel's background and then what made him such a major force within this this administration?
Yeah, so when Land wrote The Dark Enlightenment, he cited a speech, referenced a speech given by Peter Thiel. There was a discussion, I think it was held by the Cato Institute, and following that discussion, Thiel wrote an article which Land found very, Land found inspirational. And in it, it was Thiel argued that that basically that democratic politics. I mean, he echoed and was almost kind of the forerunner for much of the kind of thinking that is contained within the Dark Enlightenment. So, for example, democratic politics is an obstacle to be overcome. Because the unthinking demos, and these are Thiel's words, the unthinking demos, which means us, we are acolytes of the power structure and we can't get beyond it. In the Dark Enlightenment, the power structure is called the cathedral, and that we can't move beyond it. And we are stopping billionaire oligarchs like Peter Thiel being able to do whatever he wants, which would enable technology to move forward at the pace that advocates of the Dark Enlightenment think it needs to move in order to keep up keep humanity up with approaching the singularity. So Thiel said that there were three realms that he thought were vitally important. The first one was cyberspace. That, you know, he thought that that it would do away effectively with the need for democratic government. That you would have new forms of dissent, new forms of debate, new forms of decision making enabled by global communication networks. The second was monetary reform. He advocated a new form of currency, or a new form of money, which is common to both, technocracy. The idea is to move to these things called energy certificates. But so this idea of monetary form, and the third was seasteading, which he said would be an interim step before the conquest of space. That is very much, obviously that's aligned with the technological development that both Thiel and that network somebody else that I would highlight is Mark Anderson from Anderson Horowitz, the founder of Netscape and one of the earliest internet kind of entrepreneurs, or certainly one of the first, highly successful internet entrepreneurs. And Horowitz, is obviously part of that network as well, with Musk and Thiel and Lutnick and Ellison and people like this. And that they are very much advising and steering, I would suggest, the Trump administration. Now, Anderson's been involved in picking in Trump's picks for office. Now, he's been part of a group that have been assisting Trump in picking people for various positions, assisting. I use the word advisedly. And he wrote a document called the Techno Optimist Manifesto shortly before the Trump. I think it was in 2024, may have been earlier. But in it, he basically just says outright that that we are, and he uses the term we, and I think it's fairly obvious what network he's referring to. We are accelerationists. He calls Nick Land, who wrote The Dark Enlightenment, one of the saints of techno optimism. So it's pretty clear what this network of immensely wealthy and powerful individuals have in their minds, and it's also pretty clear how influential they are in the Trump administration.
I know that in 2020, Pronomos Capital, a venture capital firm backed by Peter Thiel and that man you mentioned, Mark Andreessen, they established the low-tax, low-regulation, nascent city-state called Prospera on the island of Rotan in Honduras. And there are plans to build 10 such freedom city-states across America. How will these cities, you just maybe describe if you could, how these cities will help to transform the larger area and ultimately the technate?
Well, the idea is that these would be a kind of autonomous areas within the US where there would be no regulation and no federal regulation. And that the people that are in charge of it, the oligarchs that are running it, would have autonomy, to basically set their own regulatory framework, which is likely to be pretty much nothing, and enable them to do whatever they like within their city states, which they're calling freedom cities. Now, this hasn't gone down very well in Honduras. The current government is trying to stop Prospera from going ahead, but there are legal wranglings involving the World Bank, there are clauses in the contract which these techno oligarchs are using, and they've launched an $11 billion lawsuit against the government of Honduras, which is sufficient to bankrupt it. So the idea of the freedom cities, I think, will probably be what we in the UK call industrial parks. I don't know what you call them in the States, but areas like Silicon Valley, where there's a lot of investment in technological development. But the view is definitely that they will bring the sales pitch, if you like, for them is that they will onshore jobs, is that they'll bring new vitality to American technological industry, that they will create wealth for the surrounding area, that these will be hubs of activity. That is very much the sales pitch. But what they are as well, I don't know quite how this would work. You probably know better than I how this would work from a constitutional perspective. It is literally ceding US territory to the exclusive control of technological oligarchs. Now, I'm not quite sure how that would work within the confines of the Constitution. I don't know that it would. I mean, it doesn't seem that I don't see how that could work. But that's basically what they are. And whether in the future, undoubtedly, the plan is that they would also become, urban areas. And one of the places where people would also reside and live, which would place them under the control of these oligarchs that have got free hand to do whatever they like. I think it's, if we look at things like, Trump spoke about the possibility of the US expanding its interests in Greenland. Well, the reason for that is not that Donald Trump has got any concept of why the US might want to expand its interests in Greenland. It's because the same network, with Mark Andreessen, Peter Thiel, also the investors of Coinbase, which was an accelerated startup under these terms accelerators are used everywhere. One of them is the Y Combinator accelerator. So these are investment startup vehicles Coinbase was one of those that came out of the Y Combinator accelerator, that they want to build one of these freedom cities on Greenland called Praxis. So that's why I would suggest that the US administration has kind of made tentative kind of statements about being interested in expanding its interests on Greenland. So, you know, I think it's evident that that what they have in mind, and I think that one of the difficulties that we have in discussing this issue is that we don't even really have the terms. I mean, GovCorp comes from the Dark Enlightenment. Obviously, TechNates comes from the original Technocracy Inc. model of technocracy. So, you know, they're combining these ideas. So, I mean, the notion of the GovCorp TechNate is something that we can use, hopefully, to describe the kind of city-states that they have in mind.
Yeah. Okay, well, in terms of bringing all of this into fruition, I mean, I think you ask your average citizen, they're not going to be keen on seeing their democracy replaced by technocracy. They've got to be, I guess, make yields of some sort. And I suppose one of the mechanisms they could do that is through our use of currency, digital currency, which apparently, if you've written, you've said that it's a lot of this currency could be used to, we can keep track of people's expenditures because it's out in the open, and it could even be programmed in some way. And I think one of the reasons that people voted for Trump is because he was going to stamp it out, and he would prohibit the establishment, issuance, and circulation and the use of the CBDC, the central bank digital currency, within the jurisdiction of the United States. Yay! But you know, instead he's bringing in things. There's the Tether, backed by Howard Lutnick's Cantor Fitzgerald, and perhaps other stable coins that but this sort of thing would give the United States an advantage internationally that they were losing now that the US dollar isn't so hot anymore and people are moving to the BRICS and other such mechanisms. So I guess I have to ask you, I mean, does this not provide any advantage to the digital currency that I just mentioned? I mean, as opposed to the CBDC?
Yeah, I mean, I think CBDC, central bank digital currency, and stable coins such as Tether are all forms of tokenized assets, or they're tokenized money, in this case, tokenized currency. From that perspective, they're not dissimilar. You know, central bank digital currency and a stable coin are technologically very similar. When Trump made the executive order, obviously, as you quite rightly say, he'd been elected promising that he would not allow the development of central bank digital currency. And sure enough, that's one of the first executive orders he made, you know, was stipulated that. But the same executive order also massively deregulated and promised to invest billions in the development of stable coins. Now, any digital currency, such as a stable coin or central bank digital currency, can be programmed using things called smart contracts. So there are certain different models. There's payment versus payment, and there's payment versus delivery. But different types of smart contracts can be written into the code of any transaction using any kind of digital currency. So, for example, you could write in a digital contract that says that that the funds won't be released until the recipient has received delivery. So that would be payment versus delivery, a simple contract written into the software. But you could also use it for other things. So, for example, if we consider what happened in Canada, where the banks restricted people's access to, for example, funding the truckers' protests, that required government legislation and government partnership with the payment providers and the banks. They needed to agree that the individuals would not be able to do this, because obviously that's seizing people's control over their funds. In a digital currency world, you could just program that into the money. So if you're using a digital wallet, you will have your digital currency, whether it's a stablecoin or CBDC makes little difference. You will have your digital wallet with your digital currency in it. Well, that currency, the currency in your wallet, can be programmed so that you know, if you're a Canadian, for example, you can't make a payment in support of, for example, a protest movement that you wish to support. You literally, you try to make the transaction and your currency literally won't work. You can't, you know, say physically, you can't digitally achieve that. That your money can be utterly controlled. So, you know, your money could be geofenced, so it doesn't work outside of certain areas. So, you know, when we're thinking about things like, I mean, if we take, for example, a Freedom City, you could issue a currency inside a Freedom City that only works in that Freedom City. So when an individual has got that currency in their wallet and they move outside of the Freedom City to try to, you know, transact elsewhere, they won't be able to because the money won't work. So the level of potential social engineering that is, and bearing in mind this needs to be linked to digital ID as well, but the potential level of social engineering that is inherent to this tokenized, digital tokenized kind of currency, identity, you know, the world that we are being rapidly propelled into, the world which people like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk want us to accept, you know, the potential for social engineering is unparalleled. It's like nothing that we have, you know, ever experienced before in terms of, you know, government control of populations. We really are talking, you know, in a highly individualized, probably AI managed, social control system.
In about 30 seconds, I just want to, like, in order to avoid these sorts of outcomes of, you know, socially engineered, so on, what can we actually do? Is there any hope that we can reverse the course towards this technocratic nightmare?
Well, I don't think we can stop those that are hell-bent on constructing it from constructing it. They're definitely doing that. But we don't have to participate. You know, there's no reason why we have to go along with it. So, for example, at the moment, people are going to airports and having their irises scanned so that they can fly. But what they don't know, if just a little bit of research and a little bit of thought, you would also know that there are slower, less convenient, but, you know, there you don't have to have your irises scanned. So don't, you know, things like that. Refuse to have your irises scanned. So there are lots of things that we can do to slow down this process and to resist it. Using cash, for example, you know, paying for everything that you possibly can with cash so that we keep cash. So, there are lots of things that we can do. But unfortunately, I don't think that the ballot box is the place where we can make those kind of changes.
Ian, thanks so much for coming on the program.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
The articles are entitled The Dark MAGA GovCorp Template and written by my guest, Ian Davis, a UK investigative journalist and author. You can find his work on his blog, iaindavis.substack.com.
That's it for this week's show. Next week, we will examine details of a possible new genocide happening in the new Syria. Join us in 7 days.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. Stay tuned. There's more great community radio coming your way.